They dined alone in Aunt Daisy's sitting room. Cleo tore into her food as if afraid the butler might grab it from under her nose. It was only after she'd mopped up the last bit of gravy that she sat back in her chair. The silence had given her time to form her words, prepare her arguments, and if need be, build a defense. "You aren't the first American citizen turning up on my doorstep looking for help getting home," Daisy said. "I've had them lining up five deep on some days. Passage out of Bergen, Trondheim, and the other coastal cities is practically impossible to find. And even the overland route through Russia is risky right now." "I don't want to go home," Cleo answered. "That's not why I came to see you." For the first time, her aunt registered surprise. "No? Why don't you enlighten me on why you did come to see me then?" Cleo had told the British businessman she'd lost her husband, but Aunt Daisy would see through that lie in a wink. She was no man's fool and no woman's patsy. "Mickey Kaminsky, the man I've been living with. My lover," she said, daring her aunt to flinch or show any embarrassment. To her credit, she remained still as stone. Cleo was reminded of the lieutenant in the way she could make herself go perfectly silent, her face open, waiting. It invited further conversation, shared confidences, spilled secrets. FDR knew what he was about when he sent Daisy Harriman here as his emissary. "He's missing," Cleo continued. "I came to ask your help to find him."
She really wasn't expected to be where she ended up being. Wanted to remain as close to the actual historical record as I could with her, so I needed another frame of reference, another perspective. It was just something that we did, something that we can talk endlessly about, the minutiae of some strange little historical quirk or something that somebody finds out.
Hello, and welcome to History Through Fiction, the podcast. I'm your host, Colin Mustful, and today I'm happy to be joined by Alex Rickloff, author of the novel The Last Light Over Oslo. Critically acclaimed author of historical fiction, Alex Rickloff's family tree includes a knight who fought during the Wars of the Roses and a soldier who sided with Charles I during the English Civil War. With inspiration like that, what else could she do but start writing her own stories? She lives in Maryland in a house that's seen its own share of history, so when she's not writing, she can usually be found trying to keep it from falling down. So let's just start with Florence Daisy Harriman. Who was she and what inspired you to tell her story?
Sure. So, oh my goodness, I could go on for ages, and I usually do when people ask me that question. Who was Daisy Harriman? She was an amazing figure in American politics, despite the fact that everybody I've talked to has never heard of her. She began life as a New York socialite, hobnobbing with Astors and Vanderbilts and J.P. Morgan's daughter and all those sort of Gilded Age women that we do know. But she quickly turned her attentions to the progressive era, the social reforms of the day. She was very interested in women's suffrage. And workplace inequalities. She actually helped found the Colony Club, which was the women's first social club in New York City, which I believe is still a going concern today. So she was tapped by President Wilson to join his Industrial Relations Committee. So she was involved in crisscrossing the United States, talking to all sorts of people from all walks of life, factory workers and coal miners, farmers, factory owners. She was sort of, she was just very much in the thick of things. So it was really no surprise that that she was ended up being chosen by FDR to become the U.S. minister to Norway in 1937. She had just definitely, she had put in the hours, the political hours. She was just everywhere doing everything.
You mentioned the Colony Club, and I was on NetGalley the other day, and did you know there's a novel coming out called The Colony Club?
I did. And actually, I just finished reading it. I got
Okay.
an early peek, and it's fabulous. Shelley does a wonderful job with that book. And but it was fun because I got to read another Daisy book, and another sort of perspective on an earlier Daisy as she was just sort of finding her feet in terms of that sort of social progressiveness. So yeah, it was a fun read. So I'm really looking forward to, I hope it does well when it comes out. I hope everybody finds it. You got to have two Daisy books in 1 year is fantastic.
Well, that makes me curious. Have there been any other fictional accounts of Daisy Harriman that you know of?
Not that I know of, but she was fabulous about writing her own story. So she put out two great memoirs, From Pinafores to Politics, sort of talks about her life up till kind of the 20s, shortly after the First World War, when she was involved in the peace negotiations. She was part of the delegation. She was very much pushing for the League of Nations. So she was in Paris during this time. So she wrote a wonderful memoir about that. And then, of course, she wrote a second memoir after the Second World War called Mission to the North, which was a fantastic resource for me, that talks about her becoming the ambassador and then all the time up to her coming home at the end of her term.
I actually did want to ask you about those memoirs. What was it like for you getting to know Harriman through the memoirs? And also, memoirs are so personal, kind of subjective. Did you have to add additional resources on top of what you got from directly from Daisy to kind of make sure you gave the most, accurate history that you could?
Sure. So yes, of course, both those memoirs were amazing resources to use, but I also went through a lot of the State Department correspondence is all publicly available. So you can see, I mean, you can just go through almost telegram by telegram, all the different embassies talking to one another, the Secretary of State talking to Daisy, Daisy talking back. And these are official, official missives that are coming flowing back and forth. So they were a good resource. And I also was able to get to the Library of Congress to go through her letters and papers from the time. So I got a lot of information from those resources as well.
Can you talk a little bit about Norway in World War II? What is the context of the novel, politically, and just the history of what was going on? Because when we study World War II, at least in my experience, we don't hear much about Norway. So what was going on there, that put Daisy Harriman center stage?
Of course. Well, originally she wasn't supposed to be anywhere near any sort of issues. I think many people believe that FDR appointed her to Norway because of its relative isolation. It was a small country, sort of a backwater. It wasn't very important to what was going on. So it was sort of a safe posting that he could give to her as a woman. So she really wasn't expected to be where she ended up being. Norway was neutral at the beginning of the war, and did as was Sweden, and it did its best, very much so, to try and maintain that neutrality. It had stayed neutral through the First World War, and it worked hard to maintain that as sort of things were heating up on the continent. Unfortunately, it had a lot of natural resources that made it very much a target for Germany. It was also, and of course, then for England. England was trying to kind of keep it out of German hands. Germany was sort of trying. So there was a lot of battles, fights, mining of waters around Norway, just to keep So the two adversaries were sort of battling it out over Norway in sort of a Cold War way in which Norway wasn't involved, but it just continued to heat up to the point where Germany, I think, just decided it was easier to occupy it, invade and occupy it, rather than let it fall into British hands, which was its fear. It was neutral. It did not expect to be invaded, though I think there were fears, obviously. You can read in the State Department correspondence and the memoirs of Norwegian politicians at the time that they were very much treading a thin line that they weren't able to maintain.
And without giving away too much of the plot and the drama in the novel, what happens with the Norwegian Crown Princess?
Of course. So Crown Princess Martha and her children, when the Germans invade Norway, they are stopped or at least slowed long enough that the royal family is able to, and a lot of the government is able to escape Oslo. So they are just enough ahead of the German advance to stay out of their hands. The prince and his father go one way, Crown Princess Martha and the children are sort of sent off to Sweden to stay safe out of German hands. But there was definitely a fear, which you can read in a lot of the correspondence back and forth. There was definitely a fear that the Germans might try to gain hold of the Crown Princess and the family, and use them sort of as a puppet regime, so that they could sort of rule through them, which sort of caused them to want to get them out of Sweden, out of harm's way.
You have another major character in this book who I believe is fictionalized. That's Cleo Jaffrey. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the role that Cleo plays in this novel.
Sure. So Cleo was a character. Her storyline is completely fictional. She is Daisy's sort of ne'er-do-well niece, goddaughter, she's sort of run off on the eve of her wedding. She's run off with this musician. She's been sort of bouncing around Europe ahead of the war and is caught up in Poland when the Germans invade there. This is when her lover goes missing in war-torn Poland, and she finally flees the country in search of help finding him. She sort of very much tries to distance herself from the war. She feels that as an American, this isn't her war, this isn't her fight. At least this is her place at the beginning of the novel. So this is very much her story arc is one of kind of coming to terms with the fact that she can't remain on the sideline of this war that's sort of taking over the world country by country.
And I kind of want to pick your brain a little bit as a writer. You must have done a lot of research about the history, about Daisy Harriman. When did Cleo come into your mind, and how did that develop over time? And really, how do you use it as a narrative craft element to enhance the actual history?
Sure. So I wanted to tell Daisy's story, but I didn't necessarily, I mean, obviously I wasn't writing a biography or a nonfiction history of this time period. I wanted to write, you know, a story, an adventure story, you know, a tale that was going to grab readers. So while Daisy's story is very much almost crazier than fiction, I really didn't have to embellish the facts of her story that much. There were other elements I wanted to bring in, and I didn't really want to meddle with Daisy's story too much. I wanted to remain as close to the actual historical record as I could with her. So I needed another frame of reference, another perspective. And Cleo became that character. I wanted her, she's sort of the polar opposite of Daisy in that she's very much, at least at the beginning of the story, she's sort of very selfish and self-centered and really just kind of, she has her own personal goal, and it's very much, it has, you know, she's not really worried about too much about what's going on around her. So she was also a way for me to have an outside perspective on Daisy, on the things that Daisy was doing that I couldn't necessarily get from, you know, Daisy's internal thoughts when I'm in her POV. So it was just, it was another way for me to play in that world, bring in some other plot points, characters, things that I couldn't necessarily do if I stuck with just Daisy and just the story of her adventure.
And kind of looking at the other side of things, you talked about all the research you did and trying to stay true to the historical record. What were there parts of the history that you ultimately had to leave out in order to make the narrative work?
There were definitely things I had to leave out. Mostly not big things. But definitely, you know, she's back and forth between places that I couldn't, I didn't want to necessarily take the reader on every little side trip she makes, every meeting she had, those sorts of things. So I condensed in places. You know, you just have to cut out certain things that may not fit exactly into the story you're trying to tell. All the major plot points of her adventure, or the places, you know, the stopping points of her adventure were straight from things that she was doing.
Your bio mentions that you have a couple notable historical figures in your own family. Can you talk about how that has inspired you to tell stories like this?
Sure. So, yes, I have a great many generations back grandfather who fought in the War of the Roses. We have the genealogy traced back. His brass rubbing hangs in my dining room, so I get to see him, Sir John Trenowith. And then I have another family member who supposedly came over, sort of, he fought in the wrong side. He was for Charles I, and ended up in Barbados and then in North Carolina very early on. So I think we've always been, I guess, knowing those stories and having those family stories. We've always been, my whole family are history nerds. We always have been. So we were always, it was just something that we did, something that we can talk endlessly about, you know, the minutia of some strange little historical quirk or something that somebody finds out, much to my husband's chagrin sometimes, as he has to sit and listen to us all chatting back and forth. So it was just one of those things that a history and telling stories and the stories that go with those sorts of family narratives and things that we bring up has always just been of interest to me. I wrote a term paper in college, and it was supposed to be about, the code of chivalry, something like that. Anyway, it was for a medieval history course. And instead of just sort of writing a dry paper, I turned it into a short story and basically followed, I invented a character and I followed him through his whole being a page to being a squire and a knight. And I had him in battles. I had him doing all kinds of things just in this term paper. I got an A, so it obviously worked, but it just goes to show you, it's just something I've always done. I've always sort of tried to turn those sorts of things. I find it much easier to learn history through fiction, through stories, rather than kind of a dry biography or a nonfiction account. I will follow along. I will Google, if I'll read a novel and it's something that catches my eye, I will be on the, you know, internet in a heartbeat, like what's fiction, what's fact, you know, where did they deviate? What did they change? I think people in general find history much more inviting and palatable when coming at it through a good story.
Yeah, I do the exact same thing when I can't get through a book because I'm looking things up all the time.
That or historical, like anything on any movie that comes on, I'm constantly like, oh, who's that character? Was that a real character? Did they really do that?
Well, you talked about writing a paper, a term paper in college, and turning it into a more of a narrative. So I'm curious to if you could elaborate a little bit on your journey from to as a writer. This obviously isn't your first novel. So what have been some of the ups and downs? How did you kind of get to the place where you're at now?
Sure, of course. Well, I've always been a writer. The term paper was not my first rodeo with doing something like that. I was penning, you know, silly stories in the second grade and my composition books, which I still have a few of them all stapled together in a box upstairs. So writing was just always, turning things into stories was just something I did, telling stories, or at least creating them in my own head for myself. And that's what I did. I wrote them for myself mainly. Early on, I would write them and shove them in a box, and that was the end of it. It wasn't until about 20 years ago that I finally got to the point where I decided, you know, maybe I should try and do something with this, you know, with all these stories that I was telling. And I joined, at that point, I joined RWA, which is Romance Writers of America, and it was a fabulous networking opportunity. I attended every craft, every, you know, workshop, everything I could on how to make myself better as a writer. And through them, I was able to find my agent, and then through her, an editor. So I wrote romance for quite a few years, historical romance. And when that, when I came to the end of a contract and wasn't sure which way to go, my agent said, you know, well, what do you want to write next? You know, just pick something. Just what have you been wanting to write and haven't had a chance to yet? And I did have a story in my head that I hadn't written down yet. So I gave it a shot, which was The Secrets of Nanreath Hall, which was my first historical fiction novel, which is set during the Second World War. So that was the story I wrote. And that was my turn, my pivot into the historical fiction community. And I haven't looked back since. It's been fantastic. But just goes to show you that... you know, you're never sure sort of where you're going to go while you're, you know, as in this writing thing, you're constantly sort of moving and pivoting and changing and adapting.
So do you see any more pivots for you, or are you thoroughly entrenched in historical fiction now?
For right now, I am thoroughly entrenched. I love it. It's sort of exactly where I want to be right now. So hopefully I can continue.
And can you tell us what ideas you have or what you might be working on next?
Well, I do have something I'm working on. It's just in proposal stage, so we haven't gotten very far. So I'm kind of keeping it under wraps for now. But it will be not World War II or World War I. So it'll be a bit of a change for me, but still in the historical fiction realm. So we'll see. Fingers crossed.
And I'm curious, ultimately, you know, we get to learn a lot about Daisy Harriman from this novel, but what kind of message do you want readers to come away with from The Last Light of Over Oslo?
I think I never go into a story with a theme in mind. They sort of come as the story unfolds. I can look back and see what I was trying to say, but I can never go into a story saying, this is what I'm going to write about. So when I came to the end of The Last Light Over Oslo and was reading it over, I saw that it was very much a novel about involvement and the choices we make. Do we sit on the sidelines and let things happen around us? Or do we become involved? Do we take a stand? Do we do what needs to be done when we see that things need to be done? And I think, you know, obviously that can translate into current times. You know, do we sit on the sidelines or do we become involved? And that's the choice that Cleo has to make ultimately, and really a choice that a lot of the characters in the story have to make.
Well, yeah, definitely very relevant for all of us today. Well, Alex, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast. Congratulations on your latest novel, The Last Light Over Oslo, and it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, this was fun. Thank you so much for having me today.